Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
And a welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 379. All right, there are really, really only a few tickets left for our Nerdist Podcast Live at San Diego Comic-Con on July 20th. That's the Saturday. I announced on Twitter that Matt Smith is going to be our guest. Matt Smith in his final appearance at Comic-Con as the Doctor. So it'll be fun. And maybe a little weepy, but mostly fun. So go to nerdist.com/calendar right now to snatch up one of the last couple of tickets. It'll be a full show. And if you're going to San Diego Comic Con, we're going to post soon on all the Nerdist goings on at nerdist.com. So go there. Go to Instagram Nerdist, Facebook Nerdist, Twitter Nerdist, Google Plus Nerdist. I really stuck with the theme, didn't I? But I would like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Going to the post office is basically like eating a bag of nails. You wonder the entire time why you're doing it. So don't! Use Stamps.com. You can print out official U.S. postage using your own computer, your printer. You're going to get the exact postage that you need. You're going to put it on your letter or package, and it's going to look professional. And people are going to get that and go, why is he so fancy? He printed out the exact postage. This was $1.31's worth of postage. Normally, you'd have to wait in line at the post office and get to the front, and they'd give you a book of stamps, and then you'd waste a bunch of money, and then you'd shout to the heavens, why? As a crane shot lifted out, echoed through your voice, went out into space, and went to the edge of the galaxy where your voice traveled over a couple of decades. Right now, there's a promo code, enter Nerdist. There's a no-risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. Head to stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. The following podcast, it's a flying solo podcast. Wait, don't turn it off. I don't know where Matt and Jonah were. You know, sometimes with the one-on-ones, I'm like, oh, am I going to be able to carry this without the sister wives there? Making comments and keeping the ball in the air. But Charlie's a fascinating guy. Dare I say, a delightful chap. And we learned a lot about how to deter burglars. We learned some acting advice that he got from Marlon Brando. And also, Sons of Anarchy stuff. He plays Jax in Sons of Anarchy. And then also Pacific Rim, which is in theaters July 12th. And you should absolutely go see because it's Guillermo's movie. And to fight monsters, we built monsters. But there are no monsters outwardly in this episode of the podcast. Well, maybe we're huggable monsters. Is that safe to say? Is it safe to say? Can Charlie and I be huggable monsters? Chloe's giving me the thumbs up. That means you're giving me the thumbs up because she's the voice of the audience, right? Why'd you just tell me to fuck myself? Oh, that's right. You're the voice of the audience. Here we go. The Nerdist Podcast number 379 with Charlie Hunnam.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Charlie Hunnam to the podcast. I'm sorry, there are normally two other guys here, but they're both out of town.
Where are they?
Matt is in Chicago, I think. I don't know where Joan is. There's a comedy festival in Chicago right now.
Okay.
And so Matt's there, and I'm not sure where Joan is, so it's just going to be one-on-one dude time.
All right.
For you and me. Have you done a podcast before?
I have not.
This is your first podcast?
It is.
All right. We're going to have to address the fact that essentially there is a secondary British invasion, which is British invasion of American characters, but I really feel like it'd be weird if there were the reverse, like if a bunch of Americans were going over and playing British characters. Do you think that would stand?
I don't know. I mean, it's a question that I've been asked a lot. It seems that the British actor has to be, flexible with the voice. There's so many regional dialects in England, so yeah. to act in England it often requires doing different accents, which is not as required of American accents. So we kind of grow up doing a lot of accent work,
yeah.
which makes it obviously easier to come over here and transition into it. But it does seem to be a one-way street at the moment. There are a few people. I mean, Renee Zellweger did a pretty good job.
She did, yeah. Actually, she did do a pretty good job.
Who else? What's his name?
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp does a pretty good job.
He does a pretty good one, but he's doing this more crazy. Like, he's doing Chimney Sweep.
Yeah.
He's basically doing Dickensian Chimney Sweep. I know it was
Johnny
like,
Depp can do whatever he wants.
He can do whatever he wants. But you know what he can't do? Just play Johnny Depp.
Maybe. It's been a while.
As an actor, do you like playing a guy that you feel like... I feel like, and I'm not an actor, but I feel like it'd be really hard just to play a guy. Just a regular guy. What does that even mean? What is just a guy without a weird quirk?
Sure. I mean, I think that's my bread and butter. I mean, I feel like that's what I can do best. But I come from an area that is just regular guys. You know, it's I come from Newcastle upon Tyne, which is a very depressed working class city in the north of England. And that's all there is there. There's really not, a huge artist community or like a... geek community or, a cool guy or rockers. It's just a lot of working class dudes. And it's almost like a place that time forgot. It seems like that type of old school man doesn't really exist as much anymore. And it doesn't even really exist in Newcastle anymore. But when I was growing up, that's all there was. There were coal miners and shipbuilders and dudes that worked the door. And, there was not a lot of kind of frilliness up there.
Did the hipsters take it over? I'm sorry, what are they called? Dickheads in England, right? Did the dickheads take it over?
Not so much the dickheads, but all of the industry closed down. The shipbuilding yards closed down. All the coal mines closed down. And actually, in an odd turn, the universities flourished. So it's a huge university town now.
That's really cool. Was it? It must have been... Well, is it... So how's a guy in a working class town... from a working class family go, hey, I think I want to do something artistic and creative? And also, how does that go over?
Well, there was one tiny, tiny little pocket of the bohemia of Newcastle in the area that I later moved to. My mom's mother, my grandmother, was a fine artist, and she really was one of the most successful artists in Newcastle. She would paint all of the portraits of the mayors and, that kind of thing. And so there was a little artistic blood. But, my mom had always had aspirations to be a ballet dancer and had gone all the way through ballet school when she was a kid. And at the, 17, 18, she found boys and alcohol and met my father, who was a real rascal son of a bitch. And he, and he kind of swept her off her feet, and she let that dream go and had children. So I grew up with her influence. But for the most part, everyone thought I was crazy. I made this declaration that I was going to be an actor at a very young age, and I don't think anyone ever really took it too seriously. And then when I got to, my adult years and was hell-bent on pursuing the dream, I think everybody just, allowed me to go and with the feeling that I would go and, fail, in my own right and then come back and do something more sensible and, knock on wood, there's time yet for that to happen, but it's been going okay so far.
Yeah, it's not, it's almost, a, I mean, maybe if you worked in a coal mine, you wouldn't think this was true, but I think it's actually harder to pursue something like this just because of the rejection rate and the amount of you know, like there's a solid chance that, you know, like in a coal mine, you can just go and work in a coal mine. You know what the job is, like mine the coal, put it in the thing, send it up, mine the coal, put, you know, but with acting, there's not really a right way. There's not really an A to B. It's there are a million ways in and a million ways it can happen and a million ways that it can express itself.
It's so true. And many times I've been asked by kind of younger aspiring people that have seen my work, you know, for advice of how to break into this industry or how I got my first break. And I just I've nothing to really say. I have no advice because it's such an intangible kind of, you know, mystical thing in a way. To me, it was about, there's a Henry David Thoreau said a wonderful thing. You know Thoreau?
Yes.
He said, I have learned this, at least from my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life that he has imagined, he will meet with success, unexpected in common hours. And to me, that's about the best advice I can give. Just if it's in your soul and it's the thing that you feel is going to make your life make sense and, you know, stave away a little of the existential crisis, then mm-hmm. go for it and make it your everything, you know, your every waking hour and every waking thought, and, you know, sleep on it and eat it and, you know, make it everything your life's about. And I think that the universe hopefully will respond and kind of help you along a way, you know, along the way. But the way you arrive there, I think, will be, you know, will be your own journey and as unlikely as you could have ever imagined.
Yeah, because it is, I mean, the idea of living with it and sleeping with it and in every waking moment, if you're passionate about it, you just do that. Like, you don't really try to do that. It's almost like you can't stop from doing that.
You wish you could stop. I mean, there were a million times when I had a brutal decade of this where I there was a couple of periods where I didn't work or make a single dollar for over 2 years. And, you know, and there's the realities of life. You know, you got to go see the doctor and it's expensive and you have to eat and you have to travel and you have to get, you know, go to auditions and everything. And I was out here for a long period of time without a work visa where I was trying to, you know, I would have a work visa to work in Hollywood, but that doesn't permit me to work on a regular job. So I couldn't even get a job waiting tables or anything like that. I could only get acting work. And so, you know, so it was very grim, and there's, you know, some long, dark nights where I thought, man, I wish I didn't feel so compelled to do this because I could just go and live a more ordinary life and actually find some happiness.
That's
you know?
Really better. You're only legally allowed to work in one of the hardest jobs to get
right.
possible. But I think, you know, I love that Thoreau quote. I always tell people, I mean, I think good advice you can give people is not so much, well, you do A and then you do B and then C happens. It's just like, look, if you love it, you'll figure it out.
Right.
You'll just figure it out. Because I think once you start down the path, once you make a decision and once you kind of feel your molecules align, you go, this is what I'm going to do. And that's it. Then as you start down that path, weirdly, I don't know if it's you become more aware or it's just the sort of the butterfly wing effect, but answers really do start to kind of reveal themselves along the way that you hadn't really seen before. So sure. It is. I think the good advice is like make the decision and then just figure it out.
Right. Right.
But
also I think that there's a kind of a mystical quality to this. You know, the people that I've seen succeed and really not only succeed in achieving their goals, but succeed in finding some happiness in achieving those goals are the ones that have a real desire to be storytellers. I mean, specifically with acting, but I think it applies to all walks of life. But the people that have like a kind of an integrity and a real passion for the thing rather than the trappings of the thing.
Yeah.
If people say to me sometimes, you know, how can I become famous? And I say, well, you know, there's a million ways to become famous.
Make
not
a
all
sex
of them,
tape.
Yeah, not all of them positive.
That's all you want. Make a fucking sex tape.
Right, sure. You know,
it's the saddest.
Rob a few banks. You know, there's many ways to become famous. If you want to become an actor and tell stories, then, you know, maybe we can have a conversation.
Yeah, because there are a lot of people who are famous and broke and have no substance, you know, and that's not really, I honestly, I would not be surprised if some weird school, I used to joke that it was going to be like USC Film School, but the more I think about it, someone's going to make a fucking, there's going to be a class in sex tape production, because it's like these people, these fucking, you know, like someone makes a sex tape and it's like, oh, they got a reality show, and now they're famous, now they're in fucking magazines. They're like, really?
Right.
Is this the path we should be telling, is this really what kids should be learning? Like, this is what you should do to, you know, like, the idea of being noticed and the idea of being famous. Do you feel like that's a detriment to the craft of acting, or is it like, yeah, it's not a big deal? I think maybe it kind of gets in the way sometimes.
Well, it certainly gets in the way of life. I mean, I have no interest in fame at all. I feel like I act to, like I mentioned before, to keep the massive, perpetual existential crisis that I'm always on the brink of away. Because I grew up really loving film and putting it was the place that I went to escape the life and the, you know, brutal reality or just the boring minutiae of day-to-day life. You know, back in the day when I was working, you know, jobs that I wasn't interested in and stuff, film was the thing that gave my life some real excitement and worth. And so the idea of being able to work in that, I felt at the end of it all, I would have feel like, you know, okay, I really did something with my life that was maybe not important in the greater scheme of the world, but at least important to me. Like, I spent my time doing something that I was passionate about.
Don't you find when you're young and you see something that you really kind of think, like, you see it in a way that most people don't see it, where you go, oh, I see what you're doing. I get it. I totally, like, you just kind of see into the fabric of it. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
I used to see that when I would watch stand-up comedy. I was like, oh my God, I feel like I understand this on a molecular level. Was that right? The same with you for film?
It was, absolutely. You know, and that grew the older I got. The genesis of it was, I remember when I was about 5 or 6, maybe even 7, I saw The Scarlet Pimpernel. Uh-huh. And I was already interested in acting and film and stuff. But I said to my mom, like, oh, this is amazing. This guy is such a badass. He can sword fight and he can ride horses and, you know, he gets to kiss the girl and all of that. But so how does that work? Do they just find a guy who rides horses and knows how to sword fight? And my mom said, I don't really know, but I would imagine it's more they find the actor that has the right energy or the right, you know, essence for the role and then teach them how to do that. And that kind of captured my imagination as a kid. I thought, what a cool job that, you know, you get to go and make films, but in the process, you get to ride horses and learn how to sword fight. And that's still a big part of the process for me. I mean, I love making movies, but almost the more fun part of it is the 3 months before where you get to learn the skill set that's required to play the part.
Did you? I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times. Did you have to learn how to ride before Sons of Anarchy?
I hadn't ridden for a long time. I rode some dirt bikes and some quad bikes and, you know, stuff like that when I was a kid, but I'd never ridden street bikes. I had to do a little bit of a crash course to remind myself.
I've never ridden one. To me, it just looks like I'm going to spend the whole time trying to figure out how to keep this massive metal horse from falling over and from it falling on top of me.
No, it's not the case. It's just like riding a bike. Once you get some inertia going, you know,
then you're
and
all good.
Have the balance, you know, it's good. But if you lose your balance, then you're fucked.
Then you're totally fucked. Yeah. That's why you got to wear leather.
Exactly.
You need the second skin. Do people expect? How do people treat you in public? Do they? Is it? You know? Do you get the? They treat you like you're your character, or they, you know, they want to talk about motorcycles, or what are they? Or are they pretty normal?
They're pretty normal. I mean, you know, you know, most people just, you know, very normal. The one thing that I've thought was interesting, and I've gotten used to it now, was that, you know, kind of tough dudes, like thugs and like gang member type of dudes, really respond to me. And so a couple of times to begin with, I was with my girlfriend once, and there were these two monster dudes with tattoos on their faces and on their necks, and they were looking at me, and normally the type of thought process that goes with that is, oh fuck, I'm about to get robbed,
right?
Which is what I was thinking. And then they walked up, I said, all right, here we go. And then they walked up and they said, hey, bro, we just want to say how much we admire you, you know, and we want to say thank you. And I said, oh, thank you for what? And they said, you make the hood safe on Tuesday nights.
Because they're in watching the show.
Because everyone's in watching Sons of Anarchy. And so that was really
cool. It's a good thing that you allowed them to talk before you were like, here's my wallet. Like,
sure.
Like, what's wrong?
Right.
Oh, I was just joking. It was a joke. You were on Undeclared, weren't you?
I was.
That was a fucking great show.
Oh, thank you.
There's another one of those shows like Freaks and Geeks where it's like, ah, snuffed out too soon.
Yep, absolutely. You know, Judd Apatow was such a talented dude, but I think he is not the most collaborative with the guys upstairs. You know, he's got a vision and his own voice that's very clear to him, and yeah. He doesn't want it interfered with. And there were all sorts of conversations when we were doing Undeclared about, well, you know, the ratings aren't great to begin with, and maybe we could put on a laugh track, and maybe we could do these type of things. And Judd just said, no fucking way.
Yeah.
And so we were canceled.
Well,
and
you know what?
That's how that went.
I mean, I gotta say, good for him for not, you know, compromising and making something that he wasn't proud. I mean, and obviously, he's carved out this very
comfortable
niche.
I think he's doing just fine for himself now.
I mean,
yeah.
He almost should call them and go, thank you for being dicks, because everything's worked out fine now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm very excited for Pac Rim. I adore Guillermo, and that movie looks insane.
Yeah, Guillermo is a badass. And I haven't seen the final cut yet, but I saw you know, a 75% done version of it, and it's pretty awesome. He created such an interesting, textured, original world that, you know, there's definitely monsters fighting robots, but the world that he created around it, that's dark and nuanced and, you know, just got so many details, is what I found so exciting about it. I mean, he really, you step into this whole creation of Guillermo's. And he shot it like a film noir. It's very dark and moody, and you know, these type of movies are usually very kind of bright and colorful. Yeah. And he kind of went for a film noir comic book movie, which is super cool.
Do you want to? Well, I think it's the, you know, people who like who've always sort of liked the kaiju movies, I think, have been just waiting for the right combination of big budget, like really, really cool looking one.
Right.
And I think, you know, there's always this one didn't quite pull it off. But I think if anyone can pull it off, I think Guillermo is probably the guy that could pull it off.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think so too. Because, you know, the thing is that Guillermo is a master filmmaker, so he would have done an amazing job anyway, but he's also one of the like 0.1% of filmmakers that would tackle this type of material that actually adores the material itself. It's not just a way to tell us a big glossy story and inhabit a world with monsters and robots. I mean, this is a guy who goes to sleep dreaming about monsters and robots and growing, you know, getting up in the middle of the night to draw sketches and stuff. So it's just such a personal film. And
yeah.
I think so seldom these type of films on this type of scale actually, you know, feel personal to the filmmaker, and you really feel his voice and his love of this in the film.
I know you're a writer. Do you also want to direct? Like, when you're around someone like Guillermo, is that an infectious energy where you go, shit, I think I might want to direct as well?
You know, it's so difficult being an actor to get through the day, and, you know, you have all of these. I mean, I go to work with all of these ideas of what I want to try to achieve that day, and, you know, sometimes you have a toothache, and, you know, sometimes you had a fight with your girlfriend, and you try to leave all of that behind and just execute as clearly and as well the vision that you had for the work for the day as possible. And for me, that just fills the day. You know, it's always very exciting to work with guys like that. In the idea of it's very exciting, but the actual process of it is much more kind of practical. And with a guy like Guillermo, that translates to just a feeling of security. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't have to worry about any of the decisions that are being made, because I know the decision ultimately is going to be right, because yeah. He's a genius, you know. And so, you know, but then when I go and see the film afterwards, I get a little of that, you know. But
I guess that's the sign of a good director, is that someone who can, you can watch something and go, I think, oh, I really want to do that now. Like, just seeing, because you see the possibility of it.
Yeah.
But in practical application, it's obviously really hard. That's why there aren't a million Guillermos in the world.
Sure.
There's just one Guillermo. I hope that, you know, with Disney doing this whole new wave of Star Wars films, I hope Guillermo does one of them. I think Guillermo in the Star Wars universe would be
incredible. Oh, my God.
Incredible.
It would be sensational.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. We shall see. I think he's pretty busy. He's got, I mean, that guy is so prolific and works so hard, but he has got a stack of material
He's
just waiting to get his hands on.
I'm going to buy Disney and then just tell Guillermo to do a stuff. Should just go do that. Do you think I should do that?
Well, if you're looking for Luke Skywalker.
Oh, shit. Oh, you'd be a good Luke Skywalker. God damn it. Yeah, I think you would be a good Luke Skywalker for this generation. Sort of a, you know, like Luke after, let's say it's Luke 10 years after he's been training.
Right.
And he's really kind of honed, you know, and he's really become kind of a badass. Holy shit. You would be fucking great. Oh, we got to make this happen.
Let's do it.
I don't know how we're going to make this happen.
Let's call Guillermo.
I just say that because I get really excited. Guillermo, hunt him, Skywalker, make it happen. And then I'll just hang up and I'll be like, who the fuck just called me?
Hey, come on.
What happened? He looks great. He's lost like 100 pounds or something.
Yeah,
he looks incredible.
He's doing great.
When you were growing up and you said, you know, you spent all this time watching movies, what type of movies besides Scarlet Pimpernel, like what other types of movies really grabbed you?
My favorite was American Crime. Obviously Scorsese was a huge guy. Abel Ferrara movies I loved, and you know, the kind of darker American crime noir films.
Yeah. Do you write though too, right? You do write screenplays.
Yes.
Is this the direction that you think you want to tackle?
Yes. I mean, I would love somewhere down the line to, I've got a film that I want to direct that is in my mind. I haven't written the screenplay yet because I think we're a few years away from being at that point. I've got a couple of other movies that I'm working on now, and I wrote my first script 6 years ago, and it was about Vlad the Impaler. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of, you know, a Braveheart-esque attempt to tell the true story of Vlad the Impaler.
So without the supernatural aspect, just the guy?
Well, yes, absolutely. Without the supernatural aspect, but of course, I mean, you know, weaving some of that mythology in, which is very easy. I mean, the real man was the inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Sure.
So it's, you know, and that was because of some of the practical application of his style of warfare. He was fighting the Ottoman Empire, and his standing army was around 30,000 men at its height. And he was fighting the Ottoman army that stood at anywhere from 150,000 to 200,000. So what he would do was go and attack their camp at night when they were all sleeping, you know. So because of that, and because, you know, he understood that, you know, it would be much better if the guys became nocturnal, because then their ease at night, you know, at operating at night would become heightened and their energy would be good at night. So for months before any given attack, they would be training in the woods at night, you know, and there was a lot of different, you know, realities of his life that was effortless to weave the Dracula mythology into it. But the studios ultimately said, we want him drinking blood. So I hope that as my career moves forward and if things continue to go well, I'll gain enough momentum that we can pull that out of the, you know, dusty hole that it's been put into, and we can make it at some point.
Is there enough literature about, like, what was the human side of that guy? Like, what was he like? I mean, you know, beyond all the I'm gonna line the walls with heads. Like, what was the human aspect of that guy? Was he a good guy, or was he just a warrior, or what?
You know, he was a fanatic. He grew up in Wallachia, which was the southernmost principality of current day Romania, which bordered the Danube. And when the Ottoman Empire came, they got across the Danube, which is the river Danube, which is very, very wide there. And they got into his principality, and they basically said to his father, listen, you can remain on the throne with complete autonomy, run the country however you want. At some point, not right now, but at some point, we're going to come back and we're going to take over your neighbors to the north. And then we'll go back and we'll, you know, we'll secure this area for a little longer. And then eventually we'll go and we'll take over their neighbors to the north. It was like a slow plan that they had for total world domination. And they were very good. The Ottoman under a son-father duo actually expanded the territories of their empire tenfold during the two of their lifetimes. So, I mean, they were, you know, they were conquerors of the mold of Alexander the Great. Only Alexander created a bigger territory in his lifetime than these two guys did. And what they said was basically, you can stay, you know, king. You can rule however you want. But when we come, you're going to give us your army and you're going to support us, and we're going to go north. And he said, wow, that seems like a pretty good deal, because everybody, you know, he wasn't particularly friendly with his neighbors at that point. All of those principalities were at constant war with each other. And so he said, okay, that sounds great. And the Sultan said, whoa, hold on. As security on this deal, I'm going to take your two youngest sons into my custody, and they will be taught and treated as their, you know, their standing would suggest. They'll be treated as princes, and we'll educate them and look after them, and I'll treat them like my own sons. But, you know, the problem was Vlad at that point was 12 years old already, and by 12 years old, back at that time, you were ostensibly a man, and had a very well-rounded idea of who he was and what his duty was, and he wasn't going to bow down to anybody. But his younger brother, Radu, was only 6 at the time and was much more malleable. So they went back to, I forget now, it's been so long. I think it was Alexandria that they were living in at that point. And they went to the castle and you know, all hell broke loose. And Vlad ended up slashing with a knife. He got a knife and he cut the Sultan's son's face open. And the son, who then became Sultan later on, carried the scar from Vlad his whole life. And so they separated the two boys, and Vlad basically got imprisoned, and Radu got turned to Islam and raised as a son and was very, very loyal to the Ottoman. Cut to 15 years later, under the treaty that they had made, the Wallachia was basically a nation of slaves. And that Vlad's father, his brother came and killed him, and Vlad heard this and went ballistic, and had been literally in a small, you know, cell, training every day, praying to Jesus Christ, you know, was, you know, devoutly Catholic, and vowed that he was going to go back and be with his father and kill the Ottoman. And he escaped from prison, and he didn't just flee. He broke back into the castle and said to Radu, "Let's go. Our father's been killed. We're going to reclaim our territory, and we're going to come back and kill every Ottoman we can see." And Radu refused to go with him, because at that point he had been completely indoctrinated into Islam and had decided he was going to stay. He was in love with the Sultan's daughter. And so Vlad left, went into the hills of Wallachia, raised a gypsy army, came back, killed his uncle, took back the throne, and thus started a 20-year war between him and the Ottoman, with his brother fighting for the Ottoman.
Oh, it's such a great story.
It's epic shit, and, you know,
the Dracula shit gets in the way of what the actual story is, which is really cool.
I have him, there's a scene in the film that I wrote where he basically battles his uncle, and he disarms his uncle, and then his uncle basically says to him, like, only a coward would kill an unarmed man, and Vlad just smiles and throws down his sword and says, "Not if unarmed too," and then literally rips his throat out with his teeth. You know, I peppered in enough stuff that you say, "Oh, that's where that came from." And you know, and the other thing, and I won't talk too much more about this, but the other thing that was wonderful about Vlad and so fascinating is that his tenure as king coincided with the advent of the printing press. And he used that to his advantage, and he really became the first kind of pulp comic book hero. They would print all of this literature that he actually was designed originally against him, but he used it to his advantage, where the kings of the north would say, "We got to do something about this guy. He's so crazy." And they would print these pictures of him impaling people and dying amongst the forest of the impale.
That's like proto-propaganda.
Exactly. And he said, "Wonderful. Let them think that." And then, you know, would play up to this to get as much of it as possible, because it struck fear into the hearts of his enemies. And so there are these wonderful wood carvings of him at the time, which I think were some of the original ones, were of him in this kind of circle of impaled men eating his dinner. And I always felt that wasn't because he was some beast, but the process of impaling, you either impale through the chest which is the much more difficult way.
Sure, yeah, it's
impale
tough.
Through the chest, and you go up. Or the more common way to impale was to insert a shaft at the top of the pail up the anus, and then slide it horizontal.
So pedestrian.
And then gravity.
Boring.
Gravity would do its work. But either way, the smell of inflammation was horrible. You know. And so if he would eat his dinner in a circle of impaled men, it was almost like, you know, it was like, you think you're a badass? Look at me, you know?
That's almost a little Cape Fear,
sure.
Right? It's almost a little bit of Cape Fear of like, you know, look what I can take. And almost sounds a little bit like it too, where he's just like stewing and training every day and,
right,
you know, just wanting to get his revenge.
Sure.
Do you think he died satisfied?
You know, I think if he had died at his height, he would have been satisfied. Towards the end, his own people kind of turned against him. You know, it was a very difficult time, and, you know, he spent 20 years at war, which destroyed the infrastructure of his country. One of the other strategies of war that he implemented was the one of scorched earth, where he basically taunted them and into pursuing him. And so they came and they had a brief little battle, and then he retreated into his own country that he knew like the back of his hand. And so they followed him. And as he retreated, he destroyed the infrastructure. He poisoned every well, he burnt every crop, he killed every flock of animals.
Shit.
And so he was very lucky because the also was one of the hottest summers, in history back then. And so as they pursued him, they got weaker and weaker and weaker because they couldn't nourish themselves. And so then they would send a party back to the Danube to get more water, and he would go around the back of them, and that party would disappear. And so that every party, advanced scouts or people to go back to water that left the main group, kept disappearing and disappearing and never being seen on again. And they were going through this desolate landscape, and every party that left the main party disappeared.
Shit.
So you can imagine what that must have done to morale, you know. And he was a brilliant practitioner of psychological warfare.
Just fucking with people's heads. Just fucking with armies.
Yeah.
He just fucked with armies.
Right. And then they would get absolutely exhausted, and then they would find some shade and rest up for 3 days. And on the second night or the third night, he would ride through their camp, hacking and slashing, killing as many people. But his strikes usually only lasted 10 minutes, and then they would be gone. And just as the camp realized they were under attack, his army had disappeared back into the forest, you know? So you can imagine. I mean, it's ripe for telling.
Would you play Vlad?
I would love to.
Ah, oh, that'd be great. That'd be fun. How do you hide the tattoos? Now, when you got the tattoos...
These are fake.
Oh, this is fake. Is this just for Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah, this is just them in the middle.
They look good. Filming.
Yeah, they're really good. It's a company called Tinsley in Los Angeles. They cost a fortune.
Because they're kind of... Can I poke it?
Yes.
Because it's sort of... can I poke your tattoos? Because what looks really good about it is that it does look like faded a bit. Like it's got a nice age to it.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a patina.
This is what I can get behind. I should just... Because my girlfriend, who just has a bunch of tattoos... And every time she gets one, she's like, this will be the last one for a while. And then a week later, so I'm thinking to get another one here. I'm like, you're addicted. And she goes, yeah, I know. Once you start, you can't stop. I don't think I could commit to one forever. But this I could get behind. I could try it out, see if I like it.
Right.
I don't know if it would look right on me, though. But it looks good.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good business to be in. I put a fresh one of these on every day, and this tattoo is $35. And it's literally just like a transfer, like you would wear like fake tattoos when you were a kid. You peel off the plastic, put a piece of paper on, wet it down, and peel the paper off, and that's the tattoo.
All right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to try it out.
All right.
I'm absolutely going to try it out.
I'll tell you what, I can send you one of these.
Would you send me one of those?
Yeah, you can get the full Jax Teller effect.
They're going to be like, this guy really likes Sons of Anarchy. Yeah, I know.
Unfortunately, you'd have to shave your arm because you can't lay it down.
I have a problem with that.
Over hair, that's why I have one hairy arm and one completely bald.
I did, you know, I was, I will admit this, I was shaving my body for a while because I was swimming as part of a workout.
Uh-huh, right.
And in the summer, you know, it's just like hot and gross, and I'm super hairy underneath. And so I did. I shaved it all off. And there's no way to not feel like a serial killer when you're shaving your body in the shower.
No, it's super psycho.
It's like, this is how Vlad did it.
Right, sure. Sure.
Do you want to do, is comedy something that appeals to you at all? Or?
I've done a little comedy. It's not my forte.
You don't like it?
You know, it's fun, and the whole process of it is so much lighter and, you know, more fun on set, and everyone's joking around and not, you know, very serious all of the time, but it's just drama is where I feel much more comfortable.
Just more comfortable, yeah.
Yeah.
Drama for me, I can't at all. I'm like, how are those people so serious? Like, it's such a, comedy's such a defense mechanism.
Right.
That in a bad situation, it's hard not to,
right.
In a drama, I'd be the guy, like, trying to crack jokes.
Right.
And then it would ruin the entire scene.
I mean, there is something, of course, you know, very earnest about drama, you know? I've heard that from comedy people, that they get on set and it's like, wow, it's, you know, almost feels silly. It's so earnest and serious, you know? But you know, it's where I feel comfortable.
Are there ever things that are so intense where you're like, there's no way to not laugh at this?
You know, it's because it's so linked to my self-worth and you know, it's always like it's much more fuck, I hope I can get there.
Yeah.
You know, it's never like a point of you know, oh, this is silly. It's like, fuck, like, get there, you know, and if you don't, then there's, you know, for me, always days and days of self-loathing and think, fuck, you know, you gotta, like, be more focused and you gotta, you know, because it's hard, you know, I read these scripts on Sons of Anarchy sometimes and I just, you know, Kurt, I just adore our showrunner and my boss, and I just think he's so talented. But, you know, he swings for the fences every episode. And so I get these scripts and I think, Christ, how are we going to act this? I mean, it's so intense, you know? And I think, all right, Kurt, well, if you think we can do it, I'll give it my best shot. But, you know.
Well, he's an amazing writer. And he obviously, it's almost like, in a way, not just writing the show, but he's almost like a trainer in a way that just is like, okay, you went this far, I'm going to push you 5 inches past that this time, and then
that's a good analogy.
You know, by the end of a season, it's like, oh, you did 5 more reps every week, and now look where you are.
Right, right. You know, I mean, I've often thought of Sons of Anarchy as a real training ground, but I guess never made that further connection that Kurt's the trainer. But
he is kind of,
it's very good.
He challenges you every week, and you know, because I guess he feels like, well, they'll probably rise to the challenge, and then you do, and then it's like, okay, right. Well, you got this far. How about this next week? I mean, it's to write a show for 4, 5, 6, you know, seasons is, I would just think, oh, as a showrunner, I would just run out of, like, how do you take these characters and then just keep throwing shit at them, and how do you make them grow and do they change? And, you know, how much do you feel like your character has changed in the past, was it 5 seasons now?
Well, not 6
on
now.
On your 6th, yeah.
I know. I don't know how he does it, frankly. I mean, like we discussed, I also, you know, attempt some writing from time to time, and it's the hardest part of Hollywood, I think. You know, getting the story and creating the world and making it all gel and make all these characters sound like they have their own voice. I truly don't know how he does it week in, week out. I mean, he has a staff of really talented writers, you know, that pitch ideas and do first drafts of scripts for him. But he's a total control freak. And so he rewrites every single script himself, edits everything himself, obviously acts in the show. So I really don't know how he does it. My hat goes off to him.
Some people are just wired that way. Some people are just wired that way.
Yeah, and I think he had a very clear idea from the very beginning of where he wanted to get to, you know, in terms of the huge, like, the big general story points in the arc of the whole thing. So he had a blueprint of where he was trying to get to, but, you know, it's amazing, and we'll see. I mean, I've often thought, you know, it's the thing with TV, which is one of the arts of it, is that you have a very, very specific amount of time. I mean, like, these episodes are supposed to come in at 42 and a half minutes. You know, you make movies, can come in and, you know, 2 hours, let's cut out 20 minutes,
right.
See how that feels. Oh, that didn't work, let's put 10 minutes back in. You know, to be doing it to time that way, and I guess that's a skill that just gets honed, and so a greater extension of that is figuring out how to, you know, tell your story in exactly 7 seasons, 13 yeah. episodes per season. But I've always said to Kurt that I trust him completely and just want to see this through to its, you know, natural, honest conclusion. So if he needs more, then we're contracted to 7 seasons. But if he needed more time, I would do another season.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's hard because I don't know when you lead an audience down a certain path and then, you know, those characters over, you know, 6 years, 7 years become a part of someone's routine in their life and they get to know the characters. It's I don't know how anyone ends a show. Like, it's almost impossible to have a series
to get a big enough
finale.
Conclusion, right?
Yeah, because everyone has their personal relationship with the show. They have a way that they feel like, even if they don't know exactly what it is, it should end a certain way. And if it doesn't, and then those characters are gone,
right?
Then they can get really, you know, like hurt
sure.
personally. So
sure.
I do not envy that job of having to take all these characters and figure out, like, how do we go out
right,
from here?
Right. And it's been such a big, I mean, aside from just the audience reaction, it's been such a big part of our lives that how to, you know, transition. I mean, we've lived with these characters and Kurt has lived with all of these guys in his head for so long. And I know, you know, when every time he has to lose a character, he deeply mourns it. I know, you know, it was very hard for him when we lost to Opie last year. It was hard for all of us, but I know he's kind of deeply mourned the loss of that character. So I've been thinking about that. I'm very good friends with Ryan Hurst, the guy that plays Opie. He's a, you know, dear friend of mine. And going through that process of even for him after, you know, 5 years of leaving the show and going back to life outside of it. It's, you know, it was a pretty hard transition for him. He wrote this beautiful piece called The Last Rites of Opie Winston as a catharsis for himself. And there's a piece of it that I just loved so much where he said, you know, in desperation, like 2 or 3 weeks after he'd, you know, been killed, and he had this, that every actor carries around a graveyard of characters they've brought to life and then had to kill, and that's just part of the gig, and we all accept that. But this, he'd been so close to this guy, and it happened so abruptly before he thought it was going to, that he hadn't had time to really say goodbye, and that he felt like this, for the first time in his life, this guy was inside him with unfinished business who wasn't going to rest in peace. And so one night he was on the internet searching Amazon for all of these like character development books. And he said there was 10,000 books on character development and not a chapter in any of them on how to kill the fucker when you were finished, you know?
Oh, he should write the manifesto for how to kill a character.
Right? It was a beautiful thing, but it kind of struck fear into my heart because I could really empathize, and I thought, God, this is been such a huge part of my life and the greatest creative experience I've had so far, that I'm slightly dreading having to say goodbye to Jax, because he really is very deeply inside me at this point.
Well, as long as your character doesn't die, there might be...
It would almost be better if he did.
So you could just, like,
have
closure.
So I could just have a little closure on it.
So that,
you know,
it's not like, oh, he's still out there somewhere.
Right.
He's still out there somewhere. I've talked about this a million times in this podcast until people are sick of hearing it, but I still feel a weird tiny hole in my... in my soul for Deadwood.
Oh, you and me both, brother.
Just like... Oh no, what happens?
And it came after the fact for me, because I never saw Deadwood when it was on, and so I kind of went into it. I can only imagine how brutal it must have been for people who were actually watching it while it was airing, because I watched it all at once in a marathon over 4 days, and just felt such a sense of loss at the end that story wasn't going to continue. So the people that had it, that were watching it episodically,
right,
and had it torn away from them.
They basically, it was a retroactive series finale because they didn't know.
Right.
And it was just like, so Hurst just gets away? Are you fucking kidding me? Like,
right.
It was just that, like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Because they just hadn't had a chance to wrap it up yet. I mean, they won't, but I had always hoped that some Deadwood fan would get to a position of power that'd be like, all right,
we're making
Milch,
the movie.
You're making the movie, and we're gonna wrap this shit up. you're going to do this one last time. But we talked about it when we had Timothy Oliphant on, and he was like, yeah, you know, it's just, I think it's done.
Yeah. It's funny. I see Oliphant a little bit on the circuit because he's on FX too. So I always ask him about that as well. And Dayton Cali, who played Charlie Potts, is a really, really good friend of mine. It must have been brutal for them because they were, you know, that it was, I think, very much experience that we have on Sons, is that they've put their heart and soul into it, and they kind of, for them, that world became real.
Yeah, you just it's every once in a while, you know, if you're friends with Tim, you just every once in a while just go up and be like, just give me a little Seth Bullock, I just give me a little taste of it so I can go on,
right?
Just almost addicted when you're acting, and you feel like you, because I'm not 100% sure how this works. The only thing that I can compare it to, which is the only thing I always compare everything to, is comedy, which is when you do a scene, and it turns out good, do you feel like you've done anything, or is the trick, I guess where I'm going with this is, sometimes on stage you can be fucking around and feel like you didn't do anything, and then it works, and then you're like, but I didn't do anything. And then someone goes, aha, yes, that's right. You weren't in your head about it.
Right.
Do you feel like the same is true of acting?
Yes, to a certain degree I do. I mean, I think, you know, I think that is the sweet spot you want to get to, is that I always try to get to, is do tons and tons of homework and think about it from every different angle and know inside and out where I am and how I'm feeling and how I feel about the guy I'm with and everything, and then try to go to work and forget it all and just be in the moment, and deep in the back of your mind or in your gut or whatever, you know all that information and can feed off of it, but are not thinking about it and just being completely kind of zen in the moment and playing off of the environment as it's kind of living and breathing around you, which is very hard to do, you know?
Well, especially when they're like, take five, and it's like, okay, I'll get back there. I got to get back there again.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, I think it's just one of those things that, you know, I'm sure you have the same experience with comedy where you just constantly feel like you're moving forward and learning, and then, you know, you'll hit a phase where you're not hitting it quite as hard and you think, fuck, what has happened? And then, you know, you recalibrate again. Exactly. The magic is gone. And then, you know, something else will happen and you'll hit it again.
Yeah. The will I ever get it back thing is a little like, that's a weird little parasite that chews at the back of your brain sometimes.
Sure.
And then, but it's, you know, you're like, well, yeah, you just kind of ignore it and you just keep doing it anyway.
Right.
I think that's really you just ignore it and you keep doing shit anyway. And then, you know, at a certain point, you start to get comfortable and you go, well, I guess it'll probably just be okay, you know, but it's really, it's hard to get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you feel comfortable yet?
It's project by project is different. You know, in day by day, I mean, I'm more comfortable than I've ever been playing Jax Teller in Sons. I mean, I feel like I've inhabited that character in a way that I never have before, in a way that he's like truly inside me and has affected my life outside of work. You know, I was talking to Kurt about this the other day, and he was actually commenting on how much he felt like I had kind of transformed Jax, and Jax had transformed me over the arc of the show so far, and I kind of had said something to him, I guess, years ago, where I guess referenced meeting a character halfway, and he said, I really feel like you've achieved that. You've kind of met this guy halfway. You've brought a lot of what's good about you to him, and a lot of what's bad, and some of what's good about him to you. You know, so we were laughing about that.
What are you, I mean, obviously Jax doesn't, maybe he doesn't think about this either way, but do you, as Charlie, how do you see him as good, you know, what do you think his alignment is? Do you see him as good? Do you see him as tortured? Do you see him as bad? Do you see him as, like, what, if you just met him in this, like, what would you think about him?
It's very interesting with Hollywood. I'm sure like a lot of people talk about this, but it gives an actor access into worlds that he'd never ordinarily be allowed into, you know? And a few times in my career, I've had that experience where I've been welcomed into environments that normally outsiders are, you know, completely kept out of. And this experience was amazing. I got to go and hang around with a very, very well-known motorcycle club up in Oakland while I was doing my research. And I was just so struck by the humanity of these guys that, you know, and it reminded me a lot of the dudes that I grew up around. I mean, my dad was like a really tough, tough dude, you know, and sometimes or a lot of his life on the wrong side of the law, and had the capacity to be incredibly violent when his back was against the wall, because he was operating in a world where other men used violence as a currency. You know, that was just an appropriate way to settle problems in the business that my dad was in, the scrap metal business. First, he was in kind of he ran doors and stuff in Newcastle, and because he was, you know, very prolific in that world, you know, he couldn't help but become a little bit involved in protection rackets, and so he was involved in that.
What is running doors?
Running doors, being doorman, because Newcastle is such a tough place, you know, very depressed and kind of working class, and where the men are real men, you go out to work a shit job, you know, 10, 12 hours a day for next to no money. And, at the weekend, everyone goes out and blows off steam. It's actually, I think in 2000 or 1999 or something like that, National Geographic did a survey of the 10 best drinking cities for a night out in the world. And Newcastle was number 5.
Oh, wow.
Of the best places for a night out. So there's hundreds of bars and nightclubs.
Got it.
In Newcastle. And so basically, you know, my father and some of the guys that he worked for, and then ultimately, you know, who did it himself, was, you know, you'd have a piece of Newcastle territory, and a guy would open a new bar and say, okay, you'd say, guy, my dad would go and say to the guy, you know who I am, and say yes, and it would make the thing, you know, the transition a lot easier. And he'd say, okay, well, here's the deal. I'm going to give you 15 good boys, you know, they'll keep your place. Because to go back a step, you know, so these guys are all hard, you know, shipbuilders, coal miners, like dudes who are really tough. And they go out and they blow off a lot of steam and have a lot of drinks. And there's a huge fighting culture there. Lot of fights in every bar, every night, every weekend night in Newcastle, particularly back in the day. So you would need 10 to 12 to 16 in a big nightclub doorman to keep everyone straight, you know, and so that there wasn't like total riot happened. So my dad would go and say, I'll give you 12 boys, they're good as gold, that will keep everybody, you know, they're not going to get carried away and start fights, you know, because that's the other thing, you know, doorman can get a little crazy. So, but they'll keep order and they'll make sure everyone behaves themselves, and in return, you'll give me 25% of your profits, non-negotiable, every week, you know? And, you know, that was just the way it works, and that's right. Protection. You basically protect them, but in the way you present it, it could be seen as extortion.
Sure. One person might say,
you know, different strokes to do, you know.
It sure would be a shame.
Sure.
If something was to happen to this pretty bar that you just opened.
Right.
I'm just saying,
exactly. So, but then my dad, cocaine hit Newcastle in the late 70s, and that changed the whole game, because then drug dealers were wanting to come in and have a piece of the action to control the bar. And then people started to get shot and hacked up sorts of stuff. And my dad just said, you know what, I'm going to step away, because my big brother had been born, and he stepped away. But so anyway, I don't know how we got on this, but long way around, I had kind of grown up with these type of dudes. And then I was reminded of it when I went up to Oakland that, you know, I think for our nice civilized lives that we live in, people who have a capacity to, you know, to commit violent acts are seen as kind of monsters, you know, or seen as, kind of intellectually inferior, or, ethically or morally inferior to us good, upstanding citizens.
Of course, yes.
But
We're so much better than everyone.
Sure,
right?
You know, but the reality is that's all bullshit. You know, it's just the kind of environment that you've grown up in and the environment that you live in day to day. And I think that Jax is just a product of environment, of his environment. I think he's doing the very best that he could possibly do in the world that he's living in. Actually, before you got here, we were talking about this kid. When I was up in Oakland, I met this incredible kid whose father was a part of the motorcycle club that I was doing research with, that had been gracious enough to let me hang out with them. And he was kind of heir apparent to the club. His dad had been in the club for, you know, 30-some years. And he had had every single one of his birthday parties in the Oakland clubhouse. And he was like 22 years old when I met him, just like a really good kid and, you know, real tough, but, you know, nice and sweet and interested in the world and always, you know, curious about everything and super gregarious, had everyone on the block loved him. And I got to hang out with him for a few days, and he made such a huge impact on me, just aside from giving me such a clear insight into who Jax Teller would, like the real Jax Teller. He had an aura about him. I just was kind of captivated by him, you know, and, you know, such a charismatic guy. And a week after I left Oakland, he got shot dead.
Oh, Jesus.
And I wear a bullet in Sons of Anarchy, this bullet that I've worn every single day since the show started, that I wear for him. And I, you know, that kind of like, I decided it was a real tragedy, and it was such a clear, you know, example of what this world was about for me. I mean, not to make it kind of, you know, the tiny little silver lining of this tragedy was a real wake-up call for me that it's not just all about kind of badass and riding bikes, and these guys are so sweet, but there is like a very, very real underbelly to it, and that's just a part of these guys' lives, just like any other part of our lives is. It just, you know, and it's very difficult for people who don't have any violence in their lives to really understand that that doesn't set people in a whole different category. They're just exactly the same, but that's just an added element to their lives.
Yeah, I guess if you have the luxury of living sort of a sheltered life, which most of us have, it's like, you know, maybe I could catch a cold this week,
right.
But in that world, it's like, I could get shot this week. Like,
I could
just, you know, like, that's just part of the reality.
And that, I do want to stress, that actually was just not even necessarily anything to do with being part of a motorcycle club. That was a random act of, he got into an argument on a freeway, and it was road rage, and the dude, guy was like kind of talking shit. Actually, a girl was talking shit, and he threw his sandwich at her, and her boyfriend just pulled out a gun and shot him.
So it's not even, so I'm sure, you know, the story would have been like, oh, this biker, and then it's like, oh, yeah. It wasn't even really about that at all.
No, not about that at all. But he was such an amazing guy. And so I thought, you know, I kind of planned to do this to a degree anyway, but as a further kind of gesture towards him, I based the whole aesthetic of Jax on him. I wear the same sneakers, exactly the same sneakers he wore, and the same jeans, and like the whole style that I have on the show.
Does his family know this?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
it's kind of a nice tribute that this guy, at least, you know, aesthetically or partially, you know, the part of the soul of this guy gets to live on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I still know a lot of the people that are, you know, very close to him and stuff. And so, yeah, they're aware of it and kind of enjoy the fact. You know, we were talking about this also right before you got here, but I get so much shit for the white sneakers that I wear on the show, and it's like, it drives me crazy. It shouldn't drive me crazy, because that's one of the things about film, that if you go out and do a lot of research and get interesting, you know, make interesting observations and apply it, you can actually show details of a world to people that they wouldn't ordinarily like know or see. And I felt like that, to the greater world, was like one of the things that I contributed to that character, was the aesthetic, which is exactly right for that area. But instead, I have thousands of people always criticizing it, saying, you know, why you wear white sneakers? Bikers don't wear white sneakers.
Like, fuck you, they do. This guy. Argh.
And I'm like, well, go to Oakland or, you know, Santa Barbara or anywhere up the, like, Southern California coast to all of these big biker communities. Every single dude you see will be wearing white sneakers, guaranteed. And then I usually, if I'm in a bad mood, well, you don't wear white sneakers, dude, because you're a fucking dentist to ride your bike 6 miles a year. If you're a Southern Cali biker and you ride every single day, you're riding flip-flops, you're riding shorts, you're wearing sneakers, whatever you want, whatever you're wearing, you know?
Yeah.
It's like kind of just the dorks that like will put on biker boots and leathers and a, like a full-face helmet and, you know, and they should be riding like that because they only ride, you know, 60 miles a year. So, you know, they're probably going to have an accident. But if you ride all day, every day, you, you know, ride, you wear whatever you want.
That's just your transportation. That's right. Like, that's just part of your day. I have a weird question, which you don't have to answer if you don't feel like it, but the story about your dad is really interesting and just, you know, where he came and just sort of questionably, you know, is this ethically right or is that that? But he's a survivor. Like, mm-hmm. What do you feel like you took from him and are there parts that you took that sort of freak you out?
What I took for him, the most positive, I think, is the fact that I can, you know, go and inhabit these type of, like, kind of old school men characters with, at least in my understanding of it and my approach to it, for me, some degree of authenticity, you know? It's hard. Hollywood's, you know, still obsessed with kind of hard guys and tough guys and heroes and the kind of guy that's going to stand up against the bad guy and knock him out if, you know, if he hurt, you know, if he's like threatening the girl. But so few people are actually, you know, growing up in their lives exposed to dudes that are like that anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so growing up with a man like that, I felt like, you know, I at least understand the psychology, if not, you know, but I honestly even have a little bit of that in me. I mean, my dad always told me, my brother, you know, there's nothing any man can do that you can't do to him. And if he hits you, just get a bigger stick and hit him back, you know? And so kind of I'd always had that mentality. And hate, like, bullies, you know. I got broken into a little while ago, and, you know, the dude was huge. He was probably, you know, 6'3" and 240 pounds, and I just, like, got so fucking mad that this guy, and a little bit scared, but more so mad that this guy was breaking into my house at 3 o'clock in the morning. My girlfriend was there, and what, was he going to hurt her? Was he going to hurt me? So I went fucking crazy on the dude. And, you know, he was, you know, begging for his life.
What?
You know, I got a machete, and I said, dude, I will...
Jesus Christ!
I had him on the ground. I was like, dude, I will straight cut you into pieces, bro. Because I just, you know, I think how fucking dare you into my house.
Did you feel like your dad for a second?
I did. I surprised myself because, you know, you always think these things through, like, oh, what would happen if a dude, you know, I always think these, and I feel most vulnerable when I'm in my shower. For some reason, I think about this stuff a lot. I don't know why. I'm maybe a little crazy. But I always think, like, what would happen in this situation? What would happen in that situation? And I always feel so vulnerable when I'm in the shower. I can't help but thinking, man, if I'm in the shower, if someone broke in now, I'd be fucked. Not only would I be naked and wet, but, like, I'm in this, like,
glass box.
How would I protect myself? You know, but you never know in the heat of the moment how it's going to go. But I just absolutely lost it. And luckily, he, you know, backed down.
You are very lucky. You are incredibly lucky.
Yeah, because if he, you know, had he had a gun, it would have been a real problem, you know.
Was it the kind of thing where it's almost like that weird Jason Bourne moment where you're like, where did that come from? I mean, were you just afterwards? Were you?
Well, I'd been broken into once before about 8 years ago, and ever since then I've been kind of conscious of it. And I was there also. That was actually through the day though, and I saw, I've kind of a long thin house, and I saw the guy walking along the side of the house, and I was like, fuck, that's a big dude in my backyard. And I had one of those one-piece garage doors, and he'd bent down at the bottom and, like, bent the whole garage door in half.
Jesus!
And just, like, walked underneath it. He's this really kind of stocky big dude. And so I saw him, and at that point I only had, like, one thing in the house. I had a baseball bat in my bedroom. So I had to sprint through the house but kind of like on the stealth mode, on the down low, because I didn't want him to see me. So I kind of like, you know, got through the house and got the baseball bat and then went out. I have French doors in my bedroom. I went out the French doors and met him, like, kind of like face to face, because he was coming round the corner. And I just like held the bat and I was like, "We got business, motherfucker." And he, and he wasn't really scared. He just kind of looked and shook his head and then like kind of sauntered, and I was so mad. I was like, "Walk faster, motherfucker." And he didn't. He continued to walk his own sweet pace out of the garage, and I was fucking so mad about it.
I love that, like, he left, but you were like, "But that's, you shouldn't leave. You should fucking run."
Yeah, run, motherfucker. I'm giving you my toughest look right now. So ever since then, I'd always been a bit weary, so I make sure I have, you know, weapons in every every room.
That would explain the machete.
And so what happened was I was in like a pool house thing, and my cat was on my knee, and he jumped off the knee and kind of stealth modes out. And he like always hears stuff. He's a little bit skittish. But then I could just tell from his reaction. He looked out the – so I'm in like the pool house sitting in a chair. I was reading my lines for the next day, and he just like – and I could see from his reaction, because he saw something and looked at it for a second and then moved his head as though he was watching something move and then like bolted out. And like I kind of like – froze for a second. I was like, "Oh fuck, there's actually someone out there." And then I heard another noise. I was like, "Man, there really is someone out there." And then all I'd left the French doors to the bedroom where my girlfriend was asleep were open, and then by the time I got up, he had walked past the door. I didn't look in to see that I was there, and he was walking towards the French doors to get in the house where my girlfriend was asleep. So I just grabbed the machete and I kept it low, like behind me, because I didn't want to like right away, because, you know, if he had a weapon, I didn't want him to know that. Sure. I had a weapon, so I could get the jump on him. And I turned around, I was like, "Oi, cunt."
Oh my god, this is your dad in bars, basically. Yeah. Like keeping people from
and he turned around and he kind of like puffed up, and then I showed him the machete, and that took the wind right out of his sail. And then I thought, fuck, I wish I had a bat, because if I have to hit him with this machete, it's going to suck.
Yeah.
You can't, like, half hit someone with a machete.
No, you got to follow through on that.
You're doing damage. I mean,
like a banana leaf. You just got to whip.
You're going to cut an arm off, or it's going to hot. Like, it was, I was thinking, can I, like, turn it sideways and, like, slap him with it? But that was just going to piss him off.
Give me a second to figure this out. I have to figure out how I strike you with this weapon.
So I thought, I'm going to just go for it. And so I did, like, a dummy hit on him, because he was, like, still kind of looking aggressive. So I did a dummy hit, and then he realized that I was actually willing to hit him with this thing, and then he, like, broke. But he had a fucking blanket, I mean a towel.
Oh, to punch through a window?
I thought, is he concealing a weapon? Because, you know, at the heat of the moment, you don't know what the hell's going on. But then my buddy was like, "No, I'll have been to break the window quietly."
See, your dad trained you well. You have that in your dad, because that's part of your DNA. Whereas my father was afraid of confrontation. And so I feel like, you know, what if that happened to me, it'd be like, "And Hardwick's last words were, 'Do we have business, motherfucker?'" And like, I would try to pull that off and never. There's something about, like, I think there must be something authentically about you that you inherited from your father, that in that mode, someone realizes, maybe it's a chemical or something, right. Or if someone realizes, like, yeah, I think this guy's actually probably gonna kill me if I don't back down.
Right.
Was it?
And I figure in thinking these things through, I figure, you know, you hear so many horror stories. I'd almost rather kill the guy in the heat of the moment and then deal with the thousands of hours of therapy after than have to deal with the reality of not protecting my girlfriend or protecting my family.
Sure.
In that heat of the moment, you know?
Sure.
But it's a horrible conundrum to have to...
Was it weirdly satisfying in a weird way, though? Like when he crumbled?
Yeah! Yeah,
I mean,
course.
As someone who was bullied as a kid, I hear those stories and I'm like, fuck yeah! It's like, there's this really great video of these guys, I think it's in London, actually, and they're basically like bullying these ladies, and then actually no, they're dudes in drag, and these just fucking lunkheads are bullying them, and what you find out is that they're essentially like UFC fighters
in drag. They're just fucking around,
and they beat them. I mean, it was just wham, and then they go down. And part of me is like, you know what? Violence does not solve violence. But the other part of me is like, fuck yeah! Like, just because I was, you know, like, kind of tortured and afraid when I was a kid.
Sure.
So it really, and I think a lot of people listening to this podcast probably feel the same way. And maybe some of them are more evolved than I am, but it's really hard not to feel kind of satisfied when you hear a story like that.
No, absolutely. No, I mean, I was kind of scrappy and kind of rough and tumble when I was a kid. But also, I moved from one place to another and got horribly bullied for years. And that was a part of me deciding, fuck it, I am getting out of here. Like, this mentality of this place is just never going to work for me, and it's always going to be an extension of this feeling. And so that was the kind of thing that drove me further inside myself and made me determined that I was going to come and fulfill my dreams,
so
you know?
It's so funny to hear this, like, because I moved a lot too when I had the same problem, but my escape was, I'll just go in the computer lab. I'll just play video games and go to chess club. Like, I didn't meet it head on. I just sort of like, oh, their bullies are over there. I'll just go this way into the computer lab, and then I'll be fine.
Right.
That was my way of dealing with it. Do you? Is this weird? Like, that hour flew by. Flew by.
It really did. Holy shit.
As we're sort of like gliding this bird in for a landing, do you have a good Perlman story? I love Perlman stories. I love Ron Perlman stories.
You know, it's funny. Actually, when you were asking me earlier about do you know when it works, one of Perlman, it's not a Perlman story, but one of his favorite stories is he loves Brando. And he had worked with Marlon Brando on the island of Dr. Monroe, and he'd been so... This actually, I've got two stories. There was one, he was in the first scene that he had with Brando. He was so in awe to be there acting with Brando, and they were all just doing their read-through, and Ron was just watching what Brando was doing, and then no one said anything for a while. The kind of dialogue ground to a halt, and then Brando just went, "It's your line, asshole." And Perlman thought, oh god, that's so fucking embarrassing for the asshole, just forgot his line, and kind of was like, so glad that wasn't me. And then Brando turned directly to him and said, "Hey, it's your fucking line, asshole."
Oh shit.
And he realized it was him. But no, but the great Brando story that he had heard secondhand was that Brando was a guy that was working with Brando and a young aspiring actor, and had been having, you know, kind of trouble breaking in and done a couple of like little bits and bobs. But Brando hated talking about acting and never wanted to discuss the process or any of that stuff. You know, he just found it very distasteful or icky to talk about. But this kid is dying to talk to him, and Brando knew that. And he said, okay, you can ask one question. And the kid said, oh, thank you. How do you know it's working? And Brando kind of smiled. He said, okay, well, I'm going to tell you, but, you know, don't, you know, just listen to what I say and, you know, don't fucking ask me any more questions. And he goes, okay, tell me. And he goes, I check my asshole. And the kid was perplexed. He said, I'm sorry. I know I wasn't going to ask any more questions, but I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. He goes, oh, fuck. Well, I'm doing the scene, and, you know, if I just check my asshole. If it's relaxed, then I figure it's good. If it's tight, I figure it's fucked up.
That is so unbelievable advice.
Just check your asshole.
Check your asshole. That might be the new way we sign off the podcast. Normally we say enjoy your burrito, which is a sort of a metaphor for, like, enjoy the present. But I feel like check your asshole is a good way to end this podcast.
At least for today.
At least for today. Charlie
check
Hunnam,
your asshole.
This has been an amazing chat. Sons of Anarchy, Pacific Rim. Thanks, man. Really, really fun hanging out with you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming
pleasure.
In on a Saturday. And check your asshole, guys.
Check your asshole.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.